Day minus 105, 0855. A Saturday in mid-July. It's perfect outside. The sky so blue it looks like a bauble fit to shatter. It's 5 to 9 and Jen is pulling up outside HMP Alt Course. As soon as she realized the date and that Joseph would still be inside, she made her excuses to Kelly and Todd, who were taking the piss out of Saturday Kitchen. She said she had brunch with a client and left. To her dismay, nobody was surprised. Jen has spent her entire life doing things for others, seeing demanding clients when she wanted to be watching Todd's swimming lessons, watching Todd's swimming lessons when she wanted to be lying down with a book. The maternal habit of a lifetime, feeling guilty no matter which she chose. Todd hasn't met Cleo yet, nor started associating with Connor. So what, were they all red herrings now that she's gone back past them? HMP Alt Course looks like an industrial estate, a strange kind of self-enclosed village. Jen's only been here once as part of her training. Beyond that, she's never practiced criminal law. Her father found the idea of repeat business from criminals so distasteful that they never did it. Jen finds making money from divorces vaguely distasteful too, but there you go. Everyone has to make rent, and heartbreak is more ubiquitous than crime. Jen walks into the foyer of the prison, thinking how fortuitous it is that Joseph is back in prison, and that visiting hours are limited and structured on weekdays, but unlimited and informal at weekends. Any unauthorized visitor can turn up and request to see any inmate on a Saturday. Today. It's like she knew. It is raining outside, midsummer rain. The media have named it Storm Richard. Each time somebody enters the reception, the smell of wet grass puffs in. Visitors' shoes leave patterns of water across the floor that a jaded cleaner mops up periodically, one hand on a hip, putting up more and more yellow triangular wet floor signs. The reception is modern, like a private hospital. A wide and sweeping desk dominates the space. A man clicks a mouse at it, takes softly spoken phone calls. Behind the reception is a whiteboard with times written on it. Through a door marked Canteen, Secure 2, Jen can hear an argument escalating. "You said I could order smoky bacon, not salt and vinegar," a man is saying. "I know, but Liam, it was fucking clear," the man shouts. Jen winces, the power of a packet of crisps. For a second, just a second, she wants to confess all, right here in the foyer, shout and scream, commit a crime, commit herself, tell them she's time-travelling and be sedated somewhere, meals made, crisp ordering the height of her control. "Request here," the receptionist says suddenly. He stands and passes a form to Jen, which she fills in. "He's happy to see you," the receptionist says after 2 phone calls and several more minutes. "Visitor centre that way." He points inwards, through a set of double doors into the bowels of the building and hands Jen a temporary pass with no string or safety pin. She pushes the cold metal panels on the doors and enters a corridor staffed by 2 security guards. It smells of disinfectant and sweat. The vinyl doors have rubber edges. There are multiple locks on multiple doors. She is met by a security guard with a name tag on, printed with the name Lloyd. Somebody in biro underneath it has written Grossman! Exclamation mark. He asks to see her handbag, then checks it, a deft hand inside like a doctor performing some grotesque internal, then sends it through an airport-style scanner. He gestures for her to spread her arms wide, and as she does so, he pats her down, avoiding eye contact. "Bone in there," he says, and Jen puts it into the blue bank of lockers he indicates. They go through another set of double doors that he opens with a fob. Underneath an over-the-door heater that momentarily warms the top of her head and shoulders, and then they're in. The visitor centre is a tired room, big and square with public sector faded blue and red carpet, black plastic chairs, tiny tables. The back wall is solely floor-to-ceiling windows. Fat raindrops strike them and the roof above, rattling the skylights. The room is already full. It's less easy than Jen thought it would be to differentiate between prisoners and visitors. It looks like any other busy meeting room. A couple sits split across a table, their hands not quite meeting at the centre of it, steadfastly not touching, but getting as close to the boundary of the rules as is possible. At another table, a child reaches towards her father, hand flexing like a distant, blinking star, but the mother stops her, pulls her back into her body. Jen thinks of her own father. She said goodbye to him in the morgue. She'd been too late. The image of her father lying there for 6 hours, dead, alone, stayed with her. In the morgue, eventually, the heat from her hand had warmed his, and she dipped her forehead to it, pretending. But it was no use. Jen recognizes Joseph Jones easily. He's sitting alone at a table in the exact center of the room. The elfin ears, the dark hair, the goatee. His skin truly does have the prisoner's pallor she's read about. Not only a lack of suntan, something more. The kind of colour people go when they have the flu, when they haven't slept, when they're grieving. She has been to this man's house. She has seen him die. And now, here she is about to find out quite who he is, after all. "Hi," she says as she sits down, her voice shaking. All his crimes, robbery, supplying, assault, her arms and legs begin to tingle. The chair shifts underneath her. It's the plastic kind that folds into a single line to stack against a wall. "Kelly's wife," he says. He pulls the ribbed cuffs of his navy blue sports jumper over his hands, playing for time. So he knows her, even though they've not yet met. Jen sees that he has a gold tooth right at the back. His eyes meet hers. "Jen," he finishes, his tongue lingering at his front teeth over the N. She has gone completely cold and completely calm. The frenzied anxiety of the mystery, of the anticipation, has boiled dry. The fuse has tripped, and now she feels nothing. The room stills around them like a faded photograph, quiet and blurred. Something is about to happen, she can feel it. "I," she says, "Jen, the love of Kelly's life." She says nothing, trying to collect herself, but instead thinks about how brazen she's been, searching belongings, following people, hiding and eavesdropping. But look where it's brought her, here. A prison, mixed up with criminals, police cars driving by, a missing baby. Her skin burns with fear like a thousand tigers' eyes are watching her. She's prey. "How do you know him?" Jen says, swallowing. "We go way back." Joseph says nothing more. He crosses his legs underneath the table, legs stretched out, his feet underneath her chair. The gesture is deliberately proprietary. Jen wants to move back, but doesn't. Outside, the light fades, the clouds Russian blue, like somebody has flicked a dimmer switch. Joseph catches her looking. "Storm Richard," he says, passing his thumb behind him. "Gonna be a big one." "Is it?" Jen says faintly. "Oh yeah, the murderer's here, love a storm." He gestures expansively around him, hypes them up. How strange that he wishes to differentiate himself from the prisoners, Jen finds herself thinking. She can't help but notice it. "Tell me how you go way back," she presses. Joseph leans across the table towards her. "You know, you'll find out when I get out of here. I'm hoping to start it up again," he says, the same thing he said in the law firm foyer. He makes another gesture, rubbing his thumb across his fingers, a signal for money or maybe just a twitch. Jen can't catch it, perhaps imagined the delicate movement. It lasted less than a second. The rest of his body is completely, eerily still. "When did you meet?" "I think Kelly's your man for this one," Joseph says. "Don't you?" Joseph rubs one of his hand tattoos, his head not moving at all, just looking at her. The wind picks up outside. A plastic bag drifts by like a balloon. "Jen," Joseph says, repeating her name, like somebody toying with her. "Jen." "What?" I have one question before I leave. Okay? And that is, Jen, how could you not know? Joseph cocks his head to the side like a bird. He's mad, Jen finds herself thinking. He's totally mad, this man who knows who she is. Even I thought you knew. Forked lightning illuminates the sky outside, a split-second flash, blink, and you'd miss it. Know what? Jen stares and stares at Joseph as the visitor's centre seems to narrow around them, as thunder flexes in the sky above. He leans closer to her, gesturing for her to do the same, left hand upturned on the desk like a beetle on its back, fingers making pulling motions towards his body. She leans in reluctantly. Ask me what we did. What? Burglaries, supply, assaults. That's what we did. Joseph's list of charges. Jen blinks, darting her head back. But you're in here, and he isn't. Ah, Joseph croaks. Welcome to the gang. Fear, realization, and horror blow across Jen's mind, like the strong winds outside. Is this what she knows? Somewhere deep and dark inside her? Kelly, a family man, not many friends, keeps himself to himself, hard to get to know, sometimes dark. Doesn't travel, doesn't like parties, doesn't go on payrolls, lives life under the radar, turns away from her friends at parents' evenings, always seems to have enough money. That dark edge he has to him, that sharp as lemons humour that prevents intimacy. Isn't that the oldest story in the book? Humour, banter, as defence mechanism? That way he sometimes will not compromise, will not elaborate, will not. Would not move back to Liverpool, will not work for an employer, will not travel, will not fly. Joseph turns his mouth down. Look, I don't dob, he says. I'm no grass. Ask your husband. He stands up now, the conversation over. Jen, not caring who's looking, allows tears to gather in her eyes as she stares at the space he left. As she sits, trying to collect herself, she feels the slightest, softest touch on her shoulder and jumps. Joseph has his mouth right next to her ear. I'm sure you'll find out the extent of it, he murmurs, then is escorted off. Jen begins trembling as though there's a freezing draught, but there isn't. It is only his breath she can feel, in her ear, in her mind, while the storm rages on outside. Day minus 144, 1830. Oh, it was mad, Todd is saying animatedly to Jen, his words tripping over each other. Jen is sitting on the love seat in their bay window, thinking that her husband is involved in organised crime. Fractional distillation didn't come up at all. We did all the prep on it. We thought it would be the main question, and it just totally wasn't. He fiddles with Henry VIII's collar, the cat lying contentedly on his lap on the sofa. It never goes the way you'd expect, you know? He shifts, unable to keep still, and the cat jumps down onto the floor. Three candles are lit along the windowsill. Jen nods, smiling at her son. The first thing she noticed this morning was that her phone was different. Her hand closed clumsily around it. It was chunkier, bigger than the slimline one that she got in early July. Shit, she thought. She knew she'd jump back further before she checked the date. It was June. The rose bush in the front garden of the house opposite was in full bloom as she stared out of her bedroom window, fat bundles of fragrant flowers clutched together about to fall. How could it be June? Where was this going to end? In nothingness? In birth? In death? And an even darker thought, it's too late for Jen to kill him herself like Kelly suggested all those days ago. He's inside. The first thing that Jen thought, getting dressed in different clothes, clothes she throws out in several months' time, was who Kelly is to Joseph, and how it might have worked. Joseph gets out of prison, comes to the law firm to find his old friend, Kelly. Todd gets involved with Cleo, doesn't like what he finds out Joseph and Kelly are doing, and kills Joseph. It was plausible, but unlikely, she concluded. It seems a weak motivation for murder. And it leaves a lot to be explained. Ryan Hiles, the missing baby, Nicola Williams, the veiled conversations between Kelly and Todd, the thing Joseph knows about Kelly. She looks at Todd now, sitting in the lamplight with cat hair all over his trousers. "You'll have aced it," she says thickly. "Well, I did actually enjoy it. Jed said I'm mental." He's giddy, with relief, with the endorphins that follow stress, and with something else, maybe, too, something that is missing in the autumn, some lightness. "I mean, am I some sadist?"
"What?"
he says, stopping, looking across the room at her. "You're not a sadist," she says, but even she can hear her voices imbued with sadness. She misses this, just normality, not fractured days, everything backwards. She doesn't even know why she's woken up on today, the 7th of June. Todd hasn't met Cleo yet. Joseph is inside. So what is it? She leans her face in the palm of her hand.
"I wonder if I'll get an A," Todd says thoughtfully. "Maybe just a B."
He gets an A. Only recently, Todd came home talking so happily about making polymer bouncing balls.
"Polymer what?" Kelly had said.
Todd had hesitated, then pulled one out of his rucksack.
"Got you one," he'd said lightly, confident enough to steal from school. They hadn't minded, thought it was funny.
He was overly interested in chemistry, so what if he shouldn't have been allowed to take it? Maybe it's that sort of thing that causes Todd to go wayward. Jen never gave much thought to what sort of parent she'd be, but maybe she was too relaxed, favouring banter over discipline, fooled by his intellect into thinking he'd never rebel. But all kids rebel, even the good ones. They just rebel differently. Jen looks at her handsome son and thinks about everything that future Todd will miss out on. University, marriage, some graduate scheme with other geniuses. But instead, what faces him? Remand, a trial, prison, out by the time he's 35? The knowledge forever that he has taken a life for whatever misguided reason?
"Are you going to order or shall I?" Todd says, waving the Domino's app at her on his phone.
They must have agreed to get a takeaway.
"Yeah, let's just wait for Dad."
Henry VIII pads over and leaps up onto Jen's lap. He is slimmer too, she thinks ruefully. Todd makes an over-the-top puzzled face, a cartoon double take.
"Okay," he says. "Dad's away, but sure, you do that, Jen."
"Is he?" she asks sharply. At risk of being accused of being old, she adds, rictus grin in place. "Remind me where he is."
"It's Whitsun."
"Oh," Jen says. She can feel her mouth make the shape a round, significant O. Kelly goes away every Whitsun weekend, camping with old friends from school, a long-standing arrangement. She's never met them, something that she had wondered about, but that Kelly had explained easily. "Oh, they're not local. I just see them on that one weekend. Honestly, it'll bore you to tears." "Pizza for two, then," she says to Todd, but in fact she's thinking, that's why today, out of all of the days that have come before. Thank God she turned on Find My iPhone this morning on Kelly's phone, the same way she does each morning now. When she checked earlier, he was in Liverpool, but she'll look again. "Let me think," Jen says, getting her phone out, ostensibly ordering pizza, but really looking at Find My iPhone. Kelly goes camping in the Lake District, Lake Windermere, same spot every year. But look, here is his blue spot. Not in the Lake District at all. At a house in Salford. Jen looks back up at her son, who is staring down at his phone, an expression of concentration on his face. "Todd," she says, cringing as she says it, her baby post-exam looking forward to pizza with his mother. He deserves better. He looks up at her in surprise. "How bad would it be if I had to pop to the office? Just quickly. We can have the pizza afterwards."
Todd's eyebrows rise in surprise, but then he waves a hand. Yeah, fine, he says. Don't worry, I shall go immerse myself in H2O, also known as a bath to mere mortals. Jen laughs softly to herself, then rubs at her eyes as he stands and leaves the living room. Is this the right thing to be doing? More neglect of Todd, not less, in search of answers. But she's got to know for sure. She decides to get a taxi so that she can arrive incognito. Won't be long, she calls to Todd. She hears the sound of the bath running, doesn't catch his reply. She hesitates at the bottom of the stairs, torn between duties. But it's all for him, she decides, as the Uber app vibrates to say her car is a minute away. It's all to save him, wonderful him. Get extra bacon on mine, Todd calls. Sure thing. She waits out on the street for the taxi. It's the height of summer. Geraniums, sweet peas, roses in her neighbour's gardens. It smells like a perfumery. The air is soft. It's raining lightly, warm drizzle, but Jen doesn't mind. It's humid, like a steam room. She reaches to pluck off the petal of a peony at the very corner of her driveway in the only tiny patch of soil they can be bothered to maintain. Once white, it's now a deep brown around the edges, like an old newspaper, but it still smells of delicious, pungent vanilla. She looks up at their sleeping house, one light on in the frosted bathroom window, thinking of her son and his pizza. He'll understand one day. As the Uber pulls up, she thinks suddenly of how much she trusted her husband. She trusted him so much. Camping with people she's never met, she never thought once. She tugs on the cool plastic handle of the Uber and is greeted by Eri, a middle-aged man with a beard wearing a baseball cap. The car smells of artificially sweet air fresheners and chewing gum. She hands him a clutch of 20 she got out of the emergency drawer in the kitchen, their paper as soft and dry as the peony petals. I'm following someone, she says. Oh, Eri considers the notes, then eventually takes them. I'll pay whatever I owe on the app, too. We need to keep an eye on this, she shows him the phone. If the blue dot moves, we might need to redirect. Okay, then, he says, like in the movies, he adds, his eyes meeting hers in the rear-view mirror. Jen sits in the back, leaning her head against the cold window, watching her street rush by. A woman in a black cab following her husband, the oldest story in the book, with a twist. Like in the movies, she repeats. Call of duty awaits you, Todd texts Jen. God, isn't it funny, Jen thinks. The lights of Merseyside rushing by like scattered colourful stars, how you can forget entire phases of your life. The PS5 phase, Call of Duty. Two controls they had to charge all the time they'd played so much. They had been so addicted. When they weren't playing it, they would shoot at each other around corners of the house. This is Black Ops, Todd would say to her, walking into the kitchen, holding an imaginary walkie-talkie. Jen wonders now as they race down the motorway, lit up blue signs passing above their heads like they're flying, whether she had been irresponsible to let her son play that game, ignoring the warnings about violent computer games. It wouldn't happen to them, she had thought. She had been too lax. She must have been. Raised by a lawyer, she'd wanted to teach a kid how to relax and have fun. But had she gone too far? Kelly's spot is at the end of a track road just a little way off the motorway junction at Salford. Eri drives dutifully, not saying anything. As Jen is considering whether this is a good idea, he says, "You don't look very happy." "No, I'm not." Eri turns the radio off completely. The air is warm, the car a lit-up cocoon. "Are you following your husband?" "How do you know?" Eri catches her gaze in the mirror, then helps himself to a second stick of powdery Wrigley's. He holds one up for her and she declines. "Usually is," he says. Jen turns her mouth down, pleading the fifth. She'd usually make small talk, try to make the taxi driver feel okay about being nosy, but she doesn't today. They come off at a roundabout, take the second exit, then head out into the country. The track road is unlit, not even tarmacked, just mud. The hairs on Jen's arms rise as they travel down it. The smells of the countryside in summer drift in through the aircon, hay bales, rain on hot pavements after a long drought. Maybe I should get a role in the films, Eri says cheerfully, following husbands. Maybe. They head up what looks like a private drive, an unmarked hairline fracture on Google Maps. Should we go all the way up? Eri asks. He takes his baseball cap off. His hair was perhaps once thick, but has now thinned out, fine strands still curling like a baby's after a bath. Eri brings the car to a stop, when Jen doesn't reply. They are about 300 feet from Kelly's dot. Jen should get out, but she hesitates, wanting to enjoy these last few minutes until something. With Eri's headlights now off, Jen's eyes adjust to the twilight drive. It winds to the left, then to the right. The sky is a bright mother of pearl, close to the summer solstice. The trees are full, shaggy, the leaves of one meeting the other. Headlights sweep the skies like laser beams. He's driving, Eri says. He reverses quickly backwards and out onto the main road. Jen glances at her phone as the blue dot begins to move. Kelly drives past them and into the distance, not seeming to notice them. Shall we follow? Eri asks. No, let's... I want to see where he was, what's at the end of this drive. Eri heads wordlessly all the way to the top. It winds this way and that, the bends obscuring what lies at the end of it. Jen is expecting to see a wedding venue, a castle, a stately home. But instead, a small and shabby housing development slides into view, one building at a time, seven houses dotted around a shingled driveway. Eri pulls the car to a stop. The houses are old stone, the windows are illuminated in four of them, the others in darkness. One is untidier than the rest, roof tiles missing, an old-fashioned wooden front door that looks rickety, near rotten. One bay window on the first story is boarded up, QAnon looped on it in pink spray paint. Eri sits in silence while Jen gazes up at it. That's the house. She's sure of it. It's the only one without a car outside. I have no idea what this is, she says. Looks dodgy. Jen's mind is spinning in overtime. A place to deal, a hideaway, a place to cut drugs, a place to kill people, a place to keep missing children, dead policemen. It could be anything, nothing good. He said he was going camping, she whispers to Eri, instead of all this. Maybe he is. Looks pretty outdoorsy, he adds with a laugh. In the Lake District. Oh. Will you wait here? She asks, easing the door handle open. I need to go and look. Course, he says, but his facial expression has become more wary. Her fleeting friend, the Uber driver, the person she has confessed the most to. She glances back at him as she goes. He's lit up by the interior light, a snow globe in the dimness. She walks tentatively across the grey shingle. The air outside is holiday air. Summertime smells, the sound of crickets. And suddenly she wishes to be back there, on the landing, with the pumpkin, watching Todd kill a man. She'd just let it happen, accept it. He'd do his time. He'd be able to have a life afterwards. She wants, for the first time, to recover this wound she has discovered. Stop discovering its depths. Move on. She walks through the darkness up to the house and tries the front door, but it's locked. It sits slightly apart from the other houses. None of them are boundaried, no fences, no front or back gardens. The neighbour has manicured their lawn up to an arbitrary straight line. After it, the wildness of this garden begins. Nettles, weeds, two giant pink lupins which nod and sway in the breeze. Jen pushes the letterbox open. It reminds her of the one they had growing up. It's stiff and cold underneath her fingertips, and she thinks of her father and the day he died, and how she didn't get there in time. Through the letterbox she can see an old-fashioned hallway, uneven quarry tiles. She presumes Kelly has picked up the post from the floor and stacked it on the hallway table there. The sign on the render to the side of the door says Sandalwood. The next cottage along says Bay. It's tiny, two rooms deep. Jen walks a clockwise loop around it. At the back are two old-fashioned sliding patio doors, the glass stained with a blush of moss. A dark wood dining table sits in a teal carpeted room inside, like a doll's house. No chairs. an empty kitchenette to the left. Nothing out on the work surfaces, not even a kettle. She presses her hands around her forehead to lean against the patio doors, peering in, and her fingers come away green. It's uncared for, but not derelict, maybe recently emptied. She circles back around to the front. The windows to the living room are mullioned, every other square a distorted circle of blown glass. The living room is preserved like a museum or a set. A pink three-piece suite sits in the centre, its arms covered in what were once white pieces of lace. A remote control rests on an empty coffee table at a diagonal angle. A full bookcase, nothing she can make out. Two dusty champagne flutes on the top. She's about to stop looking when she notices something right in the front of her field of vision. The distinctive black velvet back of a double photo frame right there on the windowsill that's littered with dead flies on their backs. The distorted glass meant she almost missed it. She shifts against the window to get a closer look. The air seems to soften and still as it comes into focus, the molecules of the universe settling around her. This is not a wild goose chase. This is not madness. Here it is. It's a photograph of Kelly, clearly Kelly, that guarded small smile. He's much younger, maybe 20, standing next to somebody else, a man with a shaved head, their arms around each other. The frame is thick with dust, and she's a foot away from it, but she can see that they look like each other. Their eyes, and something intangible too, the way families sometimes bear resemblances that aren't obvious. Bone structure, the shape of their foreheads, the way they stand, the way they seem to hold potential in their bodies, like runners on the starting blocks. So who is he, this stranger who looks like her husband? Kelly says he has no living relatives, another thing she'd always believed. She considers this as she stares at the figures in the photograph. It's one thing to lie about knowing an acquaintance who's been in prison. It's quite another to lie about your family, about where you came from. And why would her husband have a photo of himself if this house is in any way the site of something dodgy? He wouldn't. Surely he wouldn't. He's not stupid. She walks back to the Uber. He has Kelly's eyes. He has Todd's eyes. That's all she keeps thinking. Three sets of navy blue eyes, her husband, her son, and somebody else. Somebody she doesn't know, won't be able to find. Even if she breaks in, takes the photograph with her, she won't have it tomorrow. Eri is playing some platform game on his phone, holding it horizontal, pressing at the screen as tinny music plays. Sorry, he says, then locks the screen. Jen gets in the front, next to him. What, he says, in the tone of voice of somebody who feels that they have to ask. I don't know. It's empty. Jen opens the app and looks back at Find My Phone. Kelly now looks to be heading to the Lake District, where he always said he was going. But via here, this abandoned house. Who owns it? Hang on, Jen says. You can find out who owns any property from the land registry for £3. She downloads the title and scrolls to the registry. The proprietor is the Duchy of Lancaster. That's the Crown. Unclaimed property reverts to the Crown. The first thing any property lawyer learns. Jen holds her lit-up phone in her lap and stares up at the house. Mind if I smoke? Eri says as he winds his window down. Go ahead. He rasps at the lighter, two flares, and the car is briefly illuminated. He smokes and she thinks. His cigarette smells of the past, summer evenings outside wine bars, standing at train stations, the docks at night. We should go, Jen says. Will you confront him? Eri says, his cheekbones jutting out as he sucks on the cigarette. No, he'll only lie. They travel in silence, Jen thinking about the two men in the photograph, her husband and somebody else, somebody who looks like him. What does it all mean? When Jen arrives home, two pizza boxes sit on the counter, one empty, one full. Todd had his without her. He must have ordered it himself, alone. Ryan. Ryan is doing push-ups on a grimy living room floor. Bits of fluff and dirt keep sticking to his palms. He's working out for two reasons. One, he can no longer go to the gym, and two, because he cannot get the missing baby out of his mind. The gym aside, Ryan can do hardly anything he usually can. He can't go home to see his family, he can't go out with his friends, he can't even go back to his old place of abode. It happened so fast. He moved here last night to a bedsit in Wallasey. He's to live here, eat here, sleep here. It's two rooms, a bathroom, and everything else in one space. Pretty economical, really, he thinks. A sofa that folds out into a bed. A row of kitchen cabinets against the far wall. A television, a landline. What more could he need? He doesn't mind. It's exciting. And even better, it's temporary. He arrived here at 1 o'clock in the morning last night, made sure he wasn't followed, let himself into the bedsit with the key he was given at the station. As he swung his rucksack off his shoulder and onto the grim carpet, he'd let a breath out and thought, I am here. Leo had finally spelled it out the other day in the cupboard. We want you to go undercover in this group, Roy. Now, Leo said. Today. He held eye contact, not breaking away for even a millisecond, not blinking, nothing. The legend we set up is, well, it's you. Right, Ryan said with a gulp. All became clear, just like that. The corkboard. The corkboard was a way in. All the questions about his history, his brother, what he knew. He wanted this, he tried to tell himself. He wanted an interesting career, but wow, undercover work? Intercepting a gang? He suddenly wanted to know the fatality rate of undercover police, the odds, his chances. You know, you don't talk like a police officer, Leo said, and then he clarified. That's what we wanted. I see, Ryan said, not knowing whether to laugh or cry. Jesus, so he was an undercover candidate because he was nothing like a policeman. He'd even fucked up the police alphabet. Ryan bit his lip. A sad, soft feeling came over him, like he had swallowed a hot and melancholic drink. No, I mean, a police officer would say, can this gent procure me some high-class cocaine? You would say, got any beat, lad? Ryan barks a laugh out. You know I exaggerate for comedic effect. You're fucking great at intel, though. That corkboard, golden, Leo says warmly. Thank you. And now Ryan is to be introduced to the OCG by a colleague who's already in, their inside man. His phone rings. All set, says Leo. Yeah, think so. He looks out at the cold estate. It's the very tail end of winter now. The trees have been reduced to stick men. The skies are bleak, white, no colour to them at all. The weather is lacklustre. Can't be bothered to do anything at all. No sun, no rain, nothing. Remember, three pieces of advice. Okay? Ryan turns back to face the living room. One, stay in character at absolutely all times, even if you think your cover has been blown. It's better for people to suspect you're a bobby than for you to confirm it. Right, Ryan swallows. He is nervous. He can admit that much. It might be cool and stuff, but what happens if they guess? What if they get ready for the big entrapment and he blows it? Two, at every turn, crims suspect drug squads. You should too. You should be mortally offended if accused of being DS and accuse others too. I will. I'm fine with all that, Ryan says truthfully. They're sending him in quite high up to try and infiltrate the people who tip off the gang that the houses will be empty. Not into the drugs ring, but the theft ring instead. Three, never fucking tell anyone. Noted. I mean, that should be number one, really, Ryan says. Leo laughs loudly, which makes Ryan's chest feel full and happy. In his hand, Ryan has his phone, containing a text which he checks and checks again. 2 Cross Street. He's dressed all in black, as directed. The text came just as Ryan's inside man, Angela, said it would, from a blocked number. And this is what they're trying to figure out, who gets the addresses and how. Ryan had not met Angela before, as is protocol within the force. Nobody meets the active undercover officers. Angela has been on a 4-month-long project to get to know the arm of the gang involved in the thefts, and she's done a good job so far. She's stolen 4 cars and got to know Ezra at the port. In that time, she has never once set foot inside the station, in case somebody saw her. Ryan met Angela a few nights ago, facilitated from afar by Leo. They exchanged a few words outside a one-stop shop. Angela is organised and serious, resists his jokes as though they inconvenience her. Yesterday she introduced Ryan, her cousin and experienced thief, to the gang to bolster her own worth, but also to try to get Ryan to go in higher up, to get to know the person behind the intel rather than just the foot soldiers. And Ryan's first task to prove himself is this, to go to the address written here on that phone and rob the car. As easy and as difficult as that. It's after 2 o'clock in the morning. The moon is up, a luminous ball thrown into the sky that stays there for just a night before it falls again. The house in front of him is sleeping. The owners are away in the Lake District. The hallway light is the only one on, an obvious timer. That wasn't clear enough. The lawn is unruly, a clear tell people are on holiday. Ryan doesn't think about it. Just does it. Letterbox open. He's in luck. This one will be simple. The keys left within reach. He gets the long black pole out, fishes the keys out and pockets them. He unlocks the car with a gloved hand, slides in and reverses it off the drive without the engine on. If the police ever find this car and run forensics on it, that is when the undercover unit will disclose him that this is Ryan, actually. One of the good guys, immune from prosecution. On an unlit road nearby, he starts the next task. His hands are shaking. He's never plated a car. The police assumed he'd know how to do it, but he's always been rubbish at mechanics, DIY, anything like that. He can't figure out how things go together. He drops 2 tiny screws which roll around on the pavement, blending easily into the tarmac. "Shitting hell," he says, kneeling down to try and find them with his fingertips. It takes him 40 minutes to plate the car, and he cuts his hand right across the palm with the sharp edge of the number plate. But it's done. Another crime committed. Ryan drives to the port, where he waits, as instructed, for Ezra to be free, then coasts up to him, getting out and handing him the keys. "Perfection," Ezra says, right there at the cold port. Ryan loses his nerve. Imagine, imagine, imagine is all he can think. Imagine if Ezra realizes who he is. Ryan may not be in danger of getting arrested, but he is definitely in danger of getting fucking murdered. "Great," Ryan says. His hand is trembling as he reaches to clap Ezra on the shoulder. He disguises it, lets his jaw swing, a common symptom of being on cocaine. Let Ezra think it's that he's coked up like his brother's associates. Ryan looks just beyond Ezra to the cargo ships, the brightly coloured cranes against the night sky. Ezra meets his eyes. Something seems to pass between them, though Ryan doesn't know what. His knees begin to weaken, and he disguises it by hopping from foot to foot. "First one?" Ezra asks carefully. "Yeah, first of many." Ryan rocks back on his heels. They will kill him. No matter the police protection, the safe house he will go to if his cover is blown, these people will kill Ryan if they discover him. Stop thinking about it. Just stop it. "We've done 40 this week," Ezra says. 40 cars. Wow. Ryan blows air out through his mouth. The scale of this is bigger than even he realised. "You hurt your hand?" Ezra asks. "Yeah. No big deal," Ryan says, "just the number plate." "I did the same with DIY earlier," Ezra says, showing Ryan his own palm. "Ha," Ryan says, his mind spinning. "You should get Savlon on that," Ezra says casually, like they're 2 kids, not men in an organised crime gang. Fucking Savlon. Day minus 531, 0840. It's May, but May the previous year. This isn't right how far back she is. She's got to speak to Andy, to ask what to do, to stop it, to slow it down. Jen descends the stairs and can tell, just from the light and the noise of the house, Kelly is cooking, Todd chattering away, that it's a weekend. She stops on the penultimate step, just listening to her husband and her son's easy banter. That would be uninterested, Todd is saying. Disinterested means impartial. Why, thanks, OED, Kelly says. I actually did mean impartial. No, you didn't, Todd says, and they both explode with laughter. Jen walks into the kitchen. Morning, beautiful, Kelly says easily. He flips a pancake. The scene looks so normal, but... the photograph. He has some relative out there that he's never told her about. It's painful to look at him, like looking at an eclipse. Jen can feel herself squinting. What? He says again. Her gaze goes back to Todd. He is a child, a kid, an adolescent. Huge feet and hands, big ears, goofy teeth that haven't yet settled and straightened. Four spots on his cheeks, not a sniff of facial hair. He's short. She drifts over to where Kelly is flipping the pancakes. So, you were saying you are impartial to my computer game, Todd asks Kelly. Kelly's black hair catches the sunlight as he adds more pancake batter to a pan. Yeah, that's what I meant. I smell bullshit. All right, Kelly holds his hand up. Thanks for the lesson. I meant uninterested, you shitbag. Todd giggles, a high childlike giggle, at his father. Just think, you could have had two of me if you'd had another. A double pain in the ass, Todd says. Yeah, Kelly says, something old and whimsical crossing his features for just a second. He always wanted another child. You're more than enough, Jen says to Todd. Hey, we're all only children, Todd says, reaching for a banana and unpeeling it. I never thought of that before. Jen watches Kelly closely. Is it this conversation? Is that why she's here? He says nothing, busying himself in the kitchen. We are, he says casually after a second or two. Jen looks out at the garden. May. May 2021. She cannot believe it. Early morning sunbeams funnel down like shafts from heaven. Their old shed is still out there, the one they had before they got the little blue one. Jen is wondering if anybody else could tell two Mays apart, just from the way the light hits the grass. Right, I need to shower, she says. She goes to the very top of the house where she sits on the exact centre of their double bed and uses a phone she had too long ago to Google and dial Andy's number. Andy Vertese. Jen goes through the usual spiel hurriedly, the dates, the conversations they have already had. Andy keeps up in the way that he does, his silence somewhat misanthropic, but avid, Jen thinks. She tells him about the Penny Jameson in the future. He says he was being put forward for it. He seems to believe her. Okay, Jen, shoot. What do you want to ask? It's 18 months before, she says, trying to turn her attention back to the task at hand. Do the days you're landing on have anything in common? Sometimes, I always learn something, but she cradles the phone between her shoulder and her ear, rubs her hands down her legs. She's freezing cold. She has very old nail polish on, an apricot shade she went through a phase of loving but dislikes now. So many things ought to have worked to stop it that haven't. Maybe it isn't about stopping it. Huh? You say he's bad, right? This Joseph? Maybe it's not about stopping his murder. Go on. Well, if you stop it, it seems like you have another problem. Huh? Maybe it isn't about stopping it, but about understanding it so you can defend it, you know? If you know the why, then you could tell a court that. Jen's ears shiver after he's finished speaking. Maybe, maybe. She is a lawyer, after all. Yes, like it was self-defense or provocation. Exactly. Jen wishes she could go back to day zero just once, to watch it again, knowing everything she knows now. I don't know if I told you this in the future, but I always tell my wannabe time travelers the same thing. If you seek me out in the past, tell me you know that my imaginary friend was called George at school. Nobody knows that. Well, apart from the travelers I've told. So far, nobody has ever come to tell me.
I'll tell you, Jen says, moved by this personal piece of information, by this clue, by this shortcut, by this hack. She thanks him and says goodbye.
Any time, he says. Speak to you yesterday.
Jen smiles a wan, sad smile, hangs up, and thinks about today. It's all she has, after all. Today, May 2021. May 2021. Something is creeping towards her consciousness like a fine mist gathering on the horizon. It hits as some thoughts sometimes do. It arrives without warning. She checks her phone. Yes, she's right. It is the 16th of May, 2021. That's when it lands. Like a sucker punch. So violent, it knocks her off her feet momentarily. Today is the day her father dies.
Jen pretends to resist the urge to do it. She's not travelling back in order to see her father, to right one of the big wrongs in her life, she tells herself as she straightens her hair. She's not doing this to say goodbye to him. She's here to save her son. But all morning she thinks of that morgue goodbye. Just her and his dead body, his hand cold and dry in hers, his soul someplace else. She watches Todd play Crash Team Races, nitro-fueled, their game du jour, while fiddling madly, crossing and uncrossing her legs. Eventually, Todd goes, "What?" to her, and she wanders off, leaving him to it. She Googles Kelly on her phone while standing in the hallway. There is nothing, no online footprint at all. She puts his surname into an ancestry site, but it throws up hundreds of results around the UK. She finds a photograph of Kelly and reverse image searches it, but nothing comes up. She drifts upstairs. Kelly is doing his accounts. "I'm being patronised by Microsoft," he says to her, cup of coffee on a coaster, small smile on his face. As she approaches, he angles the computer just ever so slightly away from her. She catches it this time. Must have missed it the first. Maybe he has another income stream somewhere. Drugs, dead policemen, crime. Does he have more money than a painter decorator ought to? Not really. Not a lot, she doesn't think. Nothing she's ever noticed. And wouldn't she have? A memory springs up from nowhere. Kelly having given money to charity a couple of years ago. Buckets of it, several hundred pounds. He hadn't told her, and when asked, he had explained it as anonymous philanthropy, thanks to a good job that had come in. It had bothered Jen in that intangible way it does when your husband lies to you, even about something benign. The lie hadn't been bigger than what it was, but nevertheless, it had been one. "Hey, strange question," she says lightly, "but do you have any living relatives? You know, a cousin, once removed?" Kelly frowns. "No. Parents were only children," he says quickly. "Not even a very distant relative, up another generation, maybe?" "No. Why?" "Realised I'd never asked about the wider family, and I got this weird memory of seeing an old photograph of you. You were with this man who had your eyes. He was thicker set than you, same eyes, lighter hair." Kelly appears to experience a full body reaction to this sentence, which he disguises by standing up abruptly. "No idea," he says. "I don't think... Do I even have any old photographs? You know me, unsentimental." Jen nods, watching him and thinking how untrue this is. He is not at all unsentimental. "Must have made it up," she says. "They're just eyes. Perhaps it's only a friend in the photograph." Jen meets those blue irises and suddenly feels as alone as she ever has in her entire life. She is supposed to be 43, but here she is 42. She's supposed to be in the autumn, but she's in a spring 18 months before. And her husband isn't who he says he is, no matter what time zone she's in. And her father is alive. Her father, who loves her unconditionally, even if that is in his own way. Just as Jen feels she must examine her own parenting in order to save her son, she wants, now, to turn to the person who raised her. "I'm going to go see Dad," she says. It comes from nowhere. She can't resist. She needs to feel his warm hand in hers. She needs to watch him lay out the beer and the peanuts that he dies beside. She won't stay. She'll just tell him she loves him, and then leave. "Oh, cool," Kelly says. "Have fun," he calls, as she races down the stairs. "Say hi from me." Kelly and her father have always had a cordial relationship, but never close. Jen thought Kelly might search for a father figure, adopt hers willingly, but actually he did the opposite, always keeping Ken at arm's length, the way he does with most people. She calls her dad from the car, part of her brain still thinking he won't answer, but of course he does. And this proves to Jen, above almost anything else, that this is really happening, it really is. "A nice surprise," Jen's father says to her. And there he is on the end of the line, back from the dead, his voice posh, reserved, but mellowed into humour with age. Jen leans into it like a captive animal, feeling a breeze after so long, too long. "Up to much? Thought I'd come over," Jen says, her voice thick. "Sure, I'll put the kettle on." She closes her eyes into the phrase she has heard 100,000 times, but not for 18 long months. "Okay," she says. "Great." He sounds happy. He is lonely, old, dying too, though he doesn't know it yet. Everything Jen knows tells her that she shouldn't be here. All the fucking movies would agree. She should only change things that might stop the crime, right? Not get too eager, so selfish that she tries to alter other things too, to play God. But she can't resist. He lives in a double-fronted Victorian house, three stories high, including the loft conversion. Double sash windows either side of the front door, dark wood frames, old-fashioned, but charmingly so, like him. She stares at him in wonder as he steps back, gesturing to let her inside. That arm, full-bodied, warm-blooded, actually attached to her father's alive body. "What?" he says, a mystified expression crossing his features. "Oh, nothing," she says. I'm having a strange day," is all. Her father remained in the matrimonial home after her mother died. He'd insisted, and she had nobody to help her convince him. The life of the only child. He told her the stairs would be fine, that he would still keep the gutters clear himself, and neither the gutters nor the stairs killed him in the end. "How so?" "It's nothing," Jen says, shaking her head and following him down the hallway that seems smaller somehow now that she is an adult. A very specific feeling settles over Jen when she comes here, a kind of just-out-of-reach nostalgia covered in a fine film of dust, as though she might be able to grasp hold of the past if only she could try hard enough. And now here she is, right here, the spring of the year before her son becomes a murderer, the day her father dies. But it doesn't feel like it. "You sure?" he says to her. A backward glance as they move through the tired lounge, sage green carpets, hoovered carefully, but nevertheless grey-black at their edges. She'd never noticed that before. Perhaps she inherited her disdain of housework from him. A round grey rug with geometric shapes on it. Ornaments he's had for decades sit on various dark wood shelves that jut out above fireplaces and radiators. He switches on the kitchen light even though it's the middle of the day. A strip light. It hums to life. "Did Morris and Morris settle?" he asks, a raise of his eyebrows. He pronounces the verses as "and," the way all lawyers do. She hesitates. She can't remember at all, obviously. "Jen, you said it would." She tilts her head, looking up at him. This, she'd forgotten. Don't all familial irritations get subsumed by grief in the end? This sort of exchange would have annoyed her then, but it doesn't today. She's just pleased to be here, in the arena, not cast out by death. "Sorry, I'm tired." You've got 4 days before they take it off the table, he says. Suddenly, with the benefit of hindsight, she can see precisely where some of her insecurities have come from. Here. In adulthood, she gravitated away from people like her father, made friends with misanthropic types like Rakesh, like Pauline, married Kelly. They allow her to be the real, true her. I know, it'll be fine. We'll settle it on Monday, she says. What does the client think about the offer? Oh, I can't remember. She waves a hand, wanting the conversation to be over. It wasn't an idyll, was it, working together? It was hard sometimes, like this. Her father, driven, devoted, a stickler for detail. Jen, driven too, but more to help people than anything else. She vividly recalls attending an important joint settlement meeting with her father, who huffed when she didn't have one form or other, and she'd texted, "My dad is a twat," over and over to Pauline, who sent back emojis. She almost laughs now, it's so bittersweet. The children we are with our parents. Sorry, not sleeping well, she says, meeting his eyes. I'll be better on Monday, I promise. You look like, I don't know, yes, you look like when Todd was tiny and you never rested. Jen smiles a half smile. Remember those days? You can sleep anywhere when you have a baby, you're so tired, he says wistfully, just like that. A prism held to the light, he shows another facet of himself. He had always been competitive, repressed, but in the years leading up to his death, he had mellowed somewhat, began to allow himself to feel, to reveal an oozing, doughy version of himself, a better grandfather than he was a parent. They got so little time together. When I had you, I fell asleep at some traffic lights once. I never knew that, she says. An eerie sensation settles across Jen's back like a window's open somewhere, letting in cold air. What is she doing here? She shouldn't be doing this, finding out things she can never forget. I've never said, he explains. You never want your child to feel like they were a burden. He says this second sentence with evident difficulty, biting his lip as he finishes and looks at her. They're standing in his dining room, in between his living room and kitchen. The light outside is beautiful, illuminating a shaft of dust in front of his patio doors. No, I'm the same with Todd. It's hard to have a baby, nobody says, her father shrugs, seemingly pleased to be passing what he regards as a normal day with his daughter. Was I in the car with you? No, no, he says with a laugh. I was on the way to work. God, it was something else those newborn days. Sometimes I wanted to call the authorities up and say, do you know how hard it is to have a newborn? I thought Mum did it all. He turns his mouth down and shakes his head. I'm afraid to say that little Jen took over the house with those screams. She blinks as she watches him walk into the kitchen, where he painstakingly boils his stovetop kettle in that way that he always has. Full to the brim, damn the planet, the lid replaced carefully with a shaking hand. She hasn't seen that kettle for so long. They sold this house a year ago. She hardly kept anything from it. The kitchen smells antiquated, of tannin and musk, a caravan sort of smell. Why the lack of sleep? He asks. A fight with Kelly, she says, which she supposes is true. She waves a hand as tears come to her eyes. She's still thinking about the traffic lights. God, the things we do for our kids. Her father doesn't say anything, just allows Jen to speak, there, standing on the worn tiles. She meets his eyes, exactly like hers. Todd doesn't even have these eyes, these brown eyes. Todd has Kelly's. That's the deal you make when you have children with someone. What happened? Her father says. Not a sentence he would have uttered 20 years ago. The kettle begins to bubble, rocking gently on the hob. Her father keeps his eyes on hers, ignoring it, like it is a distant tremor. Oh, just the usual marital fight, she says thickly. What else could she say? Tell the whole vast story from day zero to here? Day minus 500, or thereabouts. He leans against the counter, opposite her. It's the same kitchen it always was. 80s style, off-white formica, fake oak. There's a comfort in the tired quality. Cabinets containing crystal glasses he no longer uses, a floral plastic tea tray that will house a ready meal each night. Kelly has been lying to me, she says. About what? He's involved in something dark. Maybe always has been. Her father waits a beat, then makes more of a noise than utters a word. Huh. He brings a hand to his mouth. Age spots. Jen's relieved to see them, to still be here in the relative present. What kind of thing? I don't know. He's meeting a criminal, I think, she says. Her father's eyes darken. Kelly is a good person, he says firmly. I know, but you're never, you know. What? I don't feel like you really ever liked each other. He is good to you, her father says, sidestepping her question. Jen laughs sadly. I know. She thinks of the house and the photograph again. She can't figure it out, and neither can she figure out how to figure it out. It's a locked mystery to her. Remember that first day he came into the firm? For sure, Jen says immediately, but that's all she wants to say. March belongs to her and Kelly, even if the memory has been eroded now. It means so much to them, he inked it on his skin only a few months later. He hadn't told her he was going to get the tattoo done, had disappeared in the middle of the day, came home without saying anything. It was only when she undressed him that she discovered it, their shared legacy. Remember all the scrappy work we did back then, she says. It had been the early days of the firm when her father had taken Jen on as their trainee, a recipe for dysfunction if ever there was one. He had trained at a magic circle firm in the city, but wanted to run his own firm, so moved home to Liverpool, head full of mergers, acquisitions, and ambition. After her mother died, cancer, in the 90s, he had set up Eagles. Why he hadn't called it Legal Eagles, Jen had never understood. In those early days, they had taken any work going, had stretched themselves to the limits of their expertise to avoid being late on the rent. They'd do powers of attorney alongside residential conveyancing, alongside personal injury claims. Drafting codicils with the textbook under the desk across my knees, he says, with a laugh. Jen smiles sadly. Do you remember the timeshare conveyances we did? She adds, happy to reminisce. What's that? Her father says, but there is something strange about his tone, something performative, as though somebody is watching. Yeah, remember we did timeshare conveyances, and we had to keep that mad list of whose slot was when. Did we? Of course we did, Jen says, momentarily confused. Her father has a phenomenal ability to recall events from the past. She must have misunderstood, the memory not quite what she thought. I don't think so. But weren't those the days anyway, he says. Pizzas in the office. Jen nods. Sure were, she says, though it's a lie. And then it kind of all tipped over, didn't it? Yeah. She remembers the spring when she met Kelly. The firm had finally started earning money. A few big client wins. They hired a secretary and Patricia in accounts. And now look at it, 100 employees. Stay for dinner, he says to her, pouring out 2 cups of tea. She hesitates, looking at him. It's 4 o'clock. He has between 3 and 9 hours to live. Their eyes meet. She takes her steaming mug wordlessly from him and sips it, buying time. She knows she shouldn't do it. Don't change other things. Stick to what you are supposed to be doing. Don't play the lottery. Don't kill Hitler. Don't deviate. But her mouth is opening to answer on her behalf. Love to, she says so quietly she hopes the universe might not hear if she says it under her breath, just to him, no witnesses, a private communication from daughter to father. She wants to stop being alone, just for a while, to stop figuring out all the incomprehensible clues, never moving forwards, only backwards, 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 a game of snakes and ladders with only snakes. What are we having? She adds. Her father shrugs, a happy shrug. Whatever, he says. Another person just sort of makes life feel official, doesn't it? Even if we just have beans on toast. Jen knows exactly what he means. It's 7:05. Jen and her father have put a fish pie he had frozen for God knows how long in the oven. She should be leaving. She should be leaving, she keeps thinking, her rational brain imploring her with a kind of panicky reasoning. But his feet, in slippers, are crossed at their ankles, and he's put Super Sunday on. And he's so close to it, and she can't leave him. She can't, she can't. Might put a garlic bread in the oven too, her father says. I can eat for England these days. You know, your mum hated garlic. Says she ate too much of it in pregnancy. Did she? Jen says, getting up. I'll put it in. God, I hate Super Sunday. Vacuous. He begins channel hopping. Let's watch Law and Order and criticise the procedure, Jen says over her shoulder. Now you're talking, her father says, navigating to the Sky menu. Get me a beer too, he says, and some peanuts for while we wait. The hairs on the back of Jen's neck rise up one by one like little sentries. Sure, she says. She walks into the quiet of the kitchen and puts the garlic bread in the oven. The interior lamp illuminates her socked feet. The beer is already chilling in the door of the fridge. Help yourself to whatever, he calls through. Jen finds the peanuts in a cupboard which seems to contain just about everything. Orange squash, two avocados, chocolate-covered raisins, tea bags, mink club biscuits, and brings them through for him. I didn't know Mum ate garlic when she was pregnant. Oh yes, tons of the stuff, even raw sometimes. She'd stick a few cloves in a roast chicken and eat them one by one, her father says. Jen can just imagine it. A woman she lost too soon, eating garlic cloves at the kitchen counter, greasy fingers, Jen inside her body. Todd inside Jen's. Todd's potential, anyway. Said she overdid it. We always said. He takes the beer and peanuts from her in one hand, one deft movement. God, he is so healthy. She wouldn't eat her favourite foods in pregnancy if we had another, so she didn't get put off. He leans forward and lights the fire. He wasn't found with the fire on, a garlic bread and a fish pie in the oven. These are all changes Jen has made. It lights easily, zipping along from left to right like words appearing on a typewritten page. The room is immediately filled with the soft, hot smell of gas. Jen sits down next to it on a stool her mother embroidered the top of that her father has kept. No snack or drink for her, just watching him. Waiting. What do you say to somebody when you know they will be your last words to them? You don't leave, do you? Anxiety rushes over Jen like the fire her father has just lit, making her hot. She was never going to leave. How could she possibly leave him all alone? And what if this could stop it somehow? But you didn't have another child, she says to her father, instead of cutting short the conversation, instead of leaving, instead of finding a way to say goodbye to him now and also for eternity. Never a right time, and then too late, he says simply. He opens the bottle of beer with a hiss. The law, it takes so much, doesn't it? You give it an inch. I always thought Kelly had the right idea, never letting work in so much. Who knows what ideas Kelly has? Jen says tightly, and her father looks embarrassed. He's got the right idea, he says softly. A strange and prescient feeling settles over Jen, almost like if her father knew he was going to die, he might tell her something, a key, a piece of the puzzle, a slice of deathbed wisdom that she could use, a side of the prism currently still in darkness. They lapse into silence. The gas fire, the only noise, a kind of rushing, like distant rain. It pumps out such a fierce heat, the air above it shimmers. She could stay here forever in her father's quaint old living room while a garlic bread cooks. And that's when it happens. Jen watches it pass over her father like a storm cloud. Peanuts and beer right next to him, just like they said. Sweat is the first sign. A milky dusting of it across his forehead, like he's been out in drizzle. Oh, wow, he says, puffing air into his cheeks. Jen? Jen feels hot with panic. She didn't think it would be like this. She thought it would be sudden. He brings a hand to his stomach, wincing, eyes on her. Jen, I don't feel good, he says, his voice anxious, like Todd's when he was little and fell over, looked to her first to see how he felt, his maternal mirror. And now here she is, at the end of her father's life, their roles reversed. Daddy, she says, a word she hasn't uttered for decades. Jen, call 999, please, he says. His eyes are brown, just like hers, imploring her. She gets her phone out. There is no question. There is absolutely no question. She has only the illusion of choice.